I'm Rob Sivak, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Today, a conversation about the power of history, the struggle for civil rights that we've remembered in the life and death of Martin Luther King Jr. and other leaders of the movement more than half a century ago, is a struggle that continues today. But how much do we really know about what happened in Montgomery and Memphis, and about how to connect Dr. King's work with today's Black Lives Matter movement? We don't know enough, says author and youth advocate Kevin Sherd, who joins me this hour to talk about his new book, The Colored Waiting Room, his effort to make America's civil rights history come alive in the context of today's fraught racial landscape. Plus, our biweekly check-in with the Afro newspaper. I'll be talking with managing editor Kamau High about some of the top stories in the Afro newsroom this week. But first, the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak, in for Tom Hall, and I'm glad you're joining me today. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "We are not makers of history. We are made by history." Kevin Sherd is a Baltimore-based writer, community activist, and youth advocate who has thought a lot about history. His 2014 memoir, Lessons of Redemption, chronicles his former life as a drug dealer, his prison time, and how he turned his life around to work for positive social change. His 2016 book, Uprising in the City, examines how Baltimoreans were affected by the protests and violence that erupted after the death of Freddie Gray. But Mr. Sherd gained a new appreciation for the power of history after he struck up a friendship 2 years ago with 84-year-old Nelson Mauldin of Montgomery, Alabama. Mauldin is an African-American who'd been an eyewitness to the historic civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s that played out in Montgomery and elsewhere. And he was, for more than 6 years, Martin Luther King Jr.'s barber. Mr. Sherd found in Nelson Mauldin a willing mentor and a guide, someone who could satisfy his yearning to know more about the American civil rights struggle than what he'd learned in school. Kevin Sherd describes his friendship with Nelson Mauldin and the pilgrimage he made to the American South and to Mauldin's Montgomery home in his new book, The Colored Waiting Room, Empowering the Original and the New Civil Rights Movements. It's a personal narrative that tells the story of the civil rights struggle through Nelson Mauldin's shared experience and draws lessons from it for today's new movement for racial justice. Kevin Sherd, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
We invited Nelson Mauldin to join us by phone from Montgomery, but sadly he is unable to do so today.
Right.
However, we will be hearing a few clips of Nelson during the show that he recorded for a documentary called Behind the Barber's Chair, The Nelson Mauldin Story, produced as part of the Lights, Camera, Alabama series by the Honors College at the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa, so our thanks to them. We also invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. Give us a call at 410-662-8780, tweet us at MiddayWYPR, or email us at midday@wypr.org. And we are Facebook live streaming this on the Midday Facebook page, which is at WYPR on Facebook. Yeah, just you can find us, and I hope you join us there. Okay. So, Kevin, let's start with how this book was born in your imagination. You talk in the beginning of the book about your dissatisfaction with the level of understanding about the American civil rights history and your need to know more about it,
right,
and put it into context. Where did that set you going?
So I actually met Nelson about 12 days after the 2016 presidential election, right? Just a few days later. And you remember what that time was like for the entire country.
Crazy.
Right? Crazy. It was crazy for about a year, right? So I had all these emotions, this basically negative energy stored up about that whole process. And I needed to do something with it, right? Little did I know that I would meet this 84-year-old man from Montgomery, Alabama, who would take me on his journey and help me not just understand the past, but also understand the present and vent that energy into a positive place.
Now, Nelson was in Baltimore doing a series of kind of storytelling right. presentations.
Right. Mm-hmm. So he was here in Baltimore to speak about his time with Dr. King. And I was invited. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And when I got there, he sat next to me. And his words were, I was Dr. King's barber. And it struck me like, what did he just say? And he said, I was Dr. King's barber. And we were backstage and we started this conversation. He was supposed to be speaking. We ended up speaking backstage for almost an hour and almost forgot that he was supposed to be going on stage because we got into this in-depth conversation about his time with Dr. King and his civil rights and today. And that's where it started.
Mm-hmm. And he invited you to come down to visit him in Montgomery. Now, you'd right. never been to Montgomery, Alabama before.
I'd never been to Montgomery, Alabama before. Actually, I'd only been to the Deep South as an adult one time to South Carolina to speak to some students in, I believe it was Greensboro. So I'd never been that deep in the South. And then, you know, you have this stereotype of what the South is going to be like, you know, with respect to what you've learned through history. And it was all of that and then some more. You know, mm-hmm. it was almost like you walked in a time warp and you went back like 50 years. That's what I felt like.
Yeah, you described it as an eerie experience, one that gave you uncomfortable mm-hmm. memories of the Ku Klux Klan and their activity down there, and you didn't feel that they were that far removed still from the landscape.
No. I had this feeling of, I actually had these thoughts of the Klan. I had these thoughts of police brutality. While I was there, I actually had a chance to go to Selma, and I was actually able to walk up on the William Pettus Bridge where the Bloody Sunday violence took place in 65. And it was almost like you had walked in this time machine mm-hmm. and you had went back 50 years. And Nelson was my guide.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So Nelson had this extraordinary experience of meeting the young 25-year-old Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. When he came in one day to get his hair cut. And I wanted to just, before we talk about your early relationship with Nelson, I wanted to give our audience a sense of Nelson's recollection and play this little clip of him recalling his meeting with Martin Luther King in 1954.
I
was cutting at this College Hill barbershop, and I was the youngest barber there. And during that time, the youngest barber had a chance to catch all the new customers. And so I was also a student at Alabama State, and one morning I had a 10 o'clock class, and I saw this young man drive up, and it was about 25 minutes to 10, and I never liked to cut another head after 20 minutes to the hour because I had to walk to the campus. So this young man got out of the car, looked at his head when he got out, and I said, oh, heck, I could knock him out at least 15 minutes because I could tell the length of his hair. And when he came in, I asked him what was his name. He said, Martin Luther King. I said, where are you from? He said, Atlanta, Georgia. I said, what are you doing in town? He said, I'm here to preach my crowd sermon to Dexter. I said, oh, that's my church. He said, oh, yeah, it's good to meet you. So after I finished cutting his hair, I gave him the mirror to see how he liked his haircut. And he said, pretty good. So when you tell a barber pretty good, you know, that's kind of an insult. So he came back 2 weeks later, and one of the other barbers was vacant. I was busy, but he waited on me that time. And when he got in the chair, I said, that must have been a pretty good haircut. He said, you all right. And so after I cut his hair at least 7-8 times, I noticed he never would tip me. And it wasn't so much about the money, but about the type of service I was giving him. So I decided I'd use a little psychology on him. I said, Reb, I said, when you finish preaching a sermon on Sunday, and some of the members tell you what a good sermon, I said, doesn't that make you feel good? He said, yes. I said, when you go to a restaurant, you have a nice meal, and the waitress gives you good service, and you give her a tip, I said, don't you think that make her feel good? He said, yes. So he didn't say anything else, and I didn't say anything else. So he got out of the chair, he grabbed my hand and held it real tight. He said, "Do you put 10% of your earnings in church?" I said, "Rev, I'm a student at Alabama State College. I cannot afford to put 10% of my earnings in church." I think he used a little profanity. He said, "Hell, I'm the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and I can't afford to tip you either."
That's Nelson Mauldin recalling his 1954 first meeting with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and the relationship that they established over time. In all, I think he was Reverend King's barber for six straight years that King was in Montgomery.
Right. Six straight years.
And after he left in 1960 to go back to Atlanta, he made some trips to Montgomery from time to time.
Yes. And so he was still his barber for that 8 years back and forth, you know, but he visited Montgomery very often.
Yeah.
Because Montgomery was still the epicenter of the movement at the time.
Yeah. And so talk to me about your first meeting with Nelson and your first visit down to Montgomery. What transpired? Did Nelson share with you more of the experiences that he'd had in the during the struggle in those first meetings with you?
I think we first kind of dove into. Let me just go back a little bit for a second. I had to go to Montgomery to write this book because I felt like this wasn't a book you could write from Baltimore, right? You had to be there in that space as a writer, absorbing the environment, absorbing the history. And so when I got down there, you know, Nelson basically, he started from the beginning of his life, which he was born in Alabama, but in about 9 months, his family had moved to Pensacola, Florida.
That's right.
So he grew up in Pensacola, Florida. We talked a lot about Pensacola, Florida. We talked about the segregation and the Jim Crow laws in Pensacola, Florida, and how it was affected when he was a young man. He told me this story about his first experience. His first understanding of Jim Crow, he was in the department store with his mother when he was about four or five years old, and he ran over to the water fountain, and his mother ran behind him, and she slapped him. And he, at that age, he didn't understand what he had done wrong, right? He just wanted to go get some water in the department store. And what happened, he actually ran over to the segregated water fountain that was labeled white. At the time, he couldn't read. So for a while, he internalized that, like, why did his mother, you know, slap him for simply going to get some water? And later on, he started to understand what segregation meant, what the Jim Crow laws was all about. So we started the story early on as a young person in the book. Nelson's kind of like a short bio on Nelson's life growing up in Pensacola and then moving to Montgomery in 1952 to attend Alabama State College at the time, which is now Alabama State University.
Right.
And he got a job at the barber. His two brothers were already in Montgomery. They had kind of followed the same path. They had both went to the college there, and they both became barbers. Mm-hmm. So by the time he arrived with his older brothers, things were kind of set up for him. 2 years later, he's working in a barbershop, College Hill Barbershop, which was pretty close to the college campus. And he's on his way to class one day, and Reverend King at the time pulls up in a blue Pontiac, and Nelson, he needs money to buy some clothes to take his girlfriend out on a date. Simple, you know, I think many of us at 19, 20 years old have, you know, been in that situation where we need some extra cash to take our girlfriend out on a date. So, you know, he hung around to take that last haircut to get that extra money. And it turned out to be Reverend Dr. King who would later become an iconic figure in the world.
That's how he happened to be in the barbershop at that moment.
Talk about, you know, in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, Nelson also describes the how the Jim Crow laws were kind of a fact of life in Montgomery. Mm-hmm. When you went to a restaurant to get some chicken lunch or something, or chicken dinner, you had to go around the side and have it. You couldn't actually have a seat in the restaurant. It mm-hmm. was everything was takeout, basically.
That was as the writer. You know, I'm just a recorder of history, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just a recorder. Mm-hmm. I'm just recording Nelson's story. I'm just recording the history, much of what we know today and understand today. But it's still hard for me as a black man to look back and think that this was what someone in America thought that the Jim Crow laws was good policy.
Yeah. It is hard to believe.
It's hard. But again, I was the recorder of that history, and we just wanted to use Nelson's story as a vehicle to tell a story about his time with Dr. King, but also talk about the issue of civil rights in America.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break now. Kevin Sherd is a Baltimore writer, community activist, youth advocate, and the author of a new book, his third, called The Colored Waiting Room. We'll continue this conversation after a break, and when we come back, we'll welcome your comments. Do you think Americans know enough about the great civil rights movements and leaders of the 1950s and 60s? Could that history be a key to addressing the racial divides that persist today? Give us a call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Rob Sivak in for Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch. Baltimore City's Health Commissioner, Dr. Lena Wen, will join us to discuss recent initiatives to confront the opioid crisis in Maryland. She'll also explain how federal budget cuts are threatening the city's teen pregnancy prevention program and Baltimore's new fall prevention strategy for older adults. That's all coming up tomorrow on the Midday Health Watch. And later this hour, I'll be checking in with the Afro's managing editor, Kamau High, who'll talk about some of the stories the newspaper's covering this week. If you've just joined us, my guest this afternoon is Baltimore writer and youth advocate Kevin Sherd, and we're talking about his latest book, The Colored Waiting Room, Empowering the Original and the New Civil Rights Movements. It's an account of Sherd's recent friendship with 84-year-old Nelson Mauldin of Montgomery, Alabama, a barber whose most famous client was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. You're welcome to join the conversation. What are the lessons of the old civil rights era for today's struggle for racial justice and equity? Share your thoughts with us. Call us at 410-662-8780 or email us at midday@wypr.org or tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. And we're streaming live on WYPR's Facebook page. So, Kevin, we understand the extraordinary difference between the Jim Crow South, mm-hmm. when racism was out front and legally sanctioned in the mm-hmm. in this really strange kind of almost surreal culture that we look at now, but racism has not gone away in the United States, and you talk about it as being more subtle today. But let's talk about those perceptions that you have of the problem of racism and what Nelson's experiences sort of gave you as a way of working those through.
Well, it gave me a chance to really understand that although it's not as blatant and in your face as in the past, it's still blatant in your face when you talk about diversity, equity, inclusion in corporate America, when you talk about closing the wealth gap between blacks and whites in America, when you talk about mass incarceration and the issues of that nature. It's still a major problem in America that we have to face. And so we can't just because, you know, we don't see it as blatant as, you know, the colored waiting room signs in a restaurant and in a bathroom, we still feel like we're not on an equal playing field in America.
Yeah.
And those are things that we definitely have to address. And hopefully this book is not, this is not the solution to the issue of race. What this book is to help us continue to have the conversation, have the discussion, mm-hmm. because in my view, we have to be able to have the discussion, and hopefully the discussion will get us to the table to talk about new policy, new legislation, to have an equal playing field in this country when it comes to people of color.
And in a way, I think the history lesson that we get from Nelson's experience in your visits to Montgomery and recounting that whole struggle remind us that there has been progress. I wanted to play another clip, one more clip of Nelson describing what the Montgomery bus boycott was about. And of course,
1955.
Rosa Parks was a Montgomery resident who was arrested for not giving up her seat.
A seat on a bus.
Yeah. And in response to her arrest, the black community in Montgomery decided that they would have it. They started out thinking it would be a one-day boycott of the bus system, and it turned out to be.
She went to court on Monday morning, and they thought that it would be over then. She would pay a ticket, pay the fine, and it turned into a 13-month protest.
Yeah.
And that's what the power. That's the power of protest. This is what the power of protest looks like.
Yeah. Here's Nelson talking about the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955.
What happened to Montgomery, people want to know why did the bus boycotts and the black people were so successful in staying together the 381 days. Most of the southern cities at the time had first come, first served. If the whites were filled up from the front to the rear, black from the rear to the front. What happened the day Mrs. Parks was arrested? When they left the bus terminal, there was two white women standing and one white man. So the audience had passed, if you're supposed to give up your seat, there must be an available seat back for blacks, or there must be an available seat front for white. So they asked the two black men to get up. They got up where they weren't supposed to move. Then they got up and gave the two white women the seat. And so then the white man was standing, so I asked Mrs. Parks to get up, and you know the rest of that story. She was arrested. And so that's the beginning of the boycott. So the boycott was supposed to last one day and in support of Mrs. Parks going to court.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that Montgomery bus boycott needed an organization to run it when it extended. And that's where Dr. King came in. He was the first president of the Montgomery Improvement Association, which helped to administer and manage the there were a lot of issues that people faced getting to work and getting around town without the buses. But it was an effective boycott.
And Dr. King had came to, well, then Reverend King had came to Montgomery basically for a job, right? Just a job. And when he, you know, that was 1954, December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks is arrested. And the boycott lasted again for 13 months.
Yeah,
incredible piece of history, right? Yeah. But it's a history lesson, and that's why we have to put it in a book. That's how we have to make sure that this information is available for young people. Like when I grew up, I didn't, you know, I knew the watered down version of Dr. King's life. I knew the watered down version of the Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycotts. We wasn't taught the intricate details. We wasn't taught that this could be a blueprint for us to challenge inequities in America, right? For us to challenge a broken, you know, criminal justice system. For us to challenge a broken education system. We wasn't taught those things, and that's why I really feel like this book can be a really good part of. Important piece of literature for young people that are trying to find their way in this mad world that we're living in right now, where protest and opposing injustices is important. It's vitally important.
Yeah. Well, you cite a recent Pew survey.
Right.
It was
Final chapter.
Yeah, in the final chapter, you talk about it's a Pew Research Center survey in 2016 that found that 88% of blacks surveyed in this said America needs to continue making changes to ensure blacks have equal rights, but only 53% of whites said the same. There was 84% of blacks said they were treated less fairly than whites by the police, compared to 50% of whites who agreed with that. 45% of whites said race relations in America are bad, while 45% said they're good. No such even split among black respondents. 61% said race relations were bad, and only 34% said they're good. 41% of whites compared to just 22% of blacks said there's too much attention paid to racial issues today. Sort of interesting. So clearly, there are people who don't get it yet.
Yeah, there are people that don't get it because they're not directly affected by these issues. Let's just use an example of what happened a few days ago in Philadelphia in the Starbucks, right? You're familiar with that story.
Yes.
Where the
two men came in to use the restroom.
Came to use the restroom, but they were also having a meeting there. And so they were meeting a white gentleman there to talk about real estate investment. And they were told by the staff they had to leave. The police were called. I walked into a Starbucks this morning, and that was on my mind, right? That I could come into this. And actually, I was actually having a meeting in a Starbucks this morning. And I crossed my mind that I could be potentially arrested for not buying a drink. Only because of the color of my skin, because I guarantee you, if those two young men were white, they wouldn't even have been looked at. We got to be honest. See, and that's also the thing about.
We should mention that the chief operating officer of Starbucks has apologized for that incident, and they say they're going to be talking to the store about procedures. So that clearly wasn't policy.
It wasn't policy. We just have to be able to have an honest conversation and not sweep these issues under the rug. And I commend the leaders over at Starbucks for addressing the issue. The apology is great, but let's talk about policy and so this will never happen again. And so that we have to, a discussion is great, but we got to get to a place where there's policy in place so that these types of things just won't be allowed and can't happen.
Yeah. Nelson Mauldin is a fairly optimistic voice in this book. He believes that, he's seen the progress. Of course, he would probably agree with you that that the struggle has to continue. But what are the answers? When you say we have to continue educating people about race and about respect, where does that happen?
Well, just think about what happened in those years, right? The 1965 Civil Rights Act, right? The 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Policy, right? Policy changed this country. It helped create a level playing field. We need policy. Because the only thing that's going to make a difference is the policy. The talk is great, the conversation is great, but it's got to lead to a policy. Because you're going to meet up with resistance. Everybody don't want change, and everybody definitely doesn't want change that's going to put blacks in a better place. So the only thing that you might have to force that, you might have to force it through policy, you might have to force it through legislation.
Right, but education is also something that's very important. I just wanted to bring, we've got a caller, Nancy is on the line here in Baltimore. She has a comment about education.
Nancy?
Hi, Nancy, thanks for a call.
I only in the last few years from living in Baltimore and working in the city and talking to people, black people in the black community, in really hearing their stories have I realized the depth and the breadth that the history of prejudice has in our country and in our current society. And I know that maybe a small percentage of 1% of white people actually even understand that. It's been written out of our history books. We don't realize that we're actually operating on stolen property and stolen territory and, you know, lives that have been built and benefited from the blood, sweat, tears, and oppression of black people in this country. And we think we just don't know. And so I think education and the conversation is essential and vital. And I hear what you're saying about policy, too, but I just think there's still so much, you know, blind ignorance. And a lot of white people, maybe they don't even want to know, you know, but it's so important. I'm a reading tutor at Robert Coleman Elementary School. And so I also, you know, listen to the students and observe and kind of get an idea of what's going on. And I've just been floored at the ignorance that I've had in most of my life, and even still at the vast and deep segregation that still exists.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Nancy. I appreciate that.
Wow. That's a powerful comment. And that's why the education is key, one of the keys, right? Because, and we're hoping this book can play a major role in that. Helping people better understand those issues, that so we can get to a good, better place. But again, we still have to have policy in place, because there is resistance, mm-hmm. you know, and that's where the policy, having good laws and having good policy, that's where those things come into play.
Yeah. We have another call from Michael in Fells Point about how young people handle themselves today and in dealing with race issues. Go ahead, Michael. Thanks for the call.
Hello, everyone. I was just calling because I was recently in a play for the it was showcasing the events that happened on the uprising and Pendorf for the death of Freddie Gray. Mm-hmm. It was talking about police brutality. And at the end of the show, we was having a talk back with the audience about, you know, the thoughts and feelings about how they felt about the show. And a young boy raised his hand, and he had a question for the cast. He was probably like 7 or 8. And he said, what would you tell the younger generation of how to handle ourselves in this very violent world we live in? And everybody was like, wow.
Wow, yeah.
It was just like, what do you
That's
say
a deep
to that?
Question,
like,
yeah.
And he's just seen that, like, it was just amazing. I just wanted to say that and just mm-hmm. hear you guys' reaction to that.
Yeah, so. Thanks. Thanks for the call, Michael. What do you think, Kevin?
Wow, he's a product of his environment, no doubt. He didn't just make that up. You know what I mean? And, you know, young kid living in the inner city, unfortunately, witnessing violence, you know, being a victim of violence is happens far too often. And our young people see this, and they don't know how to react to it. That's tough. That's mm-hmm. tough. I've heard it before. I've heard it several times before.
Nonviolence was such an important part of Dr. King's movement. You know, even in his dealings with the Black Panthers and the Black Power movement, I think he advocated so strongly mm-hmm. still for nonviolence and the power of that movement. Mm-hmm. Is it harder to sell that today? Is it,
no,
you know?
No, it's not hard to sell. Like, there's plenty of nonviolent protests that go. Matter of fact, the majority of the protesting that goes on in America today is nonviolent, right? So it's not, you know, it's, I think people get it. And, you know, I don't even know activists that, you know, say, let's go out and burn stuff down, right?
Right.
I know activists that say, let's go out and let's make our voices heard, right? So I think that's kind of like a myth, in a sense that today there's so much violence when it's connected to advocacy and activism. That's just not the case, you know?
Kevin, we're running out of time, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to give you a, you know, we've got a few seconds left, but I wanted to note that you know, you close the book by saying that African Americans have been sitting in the colored waiting room for many years, segregated from the American dream, and we're still waiting for our turn. Are you optimistic about people's minds being open to change?
So people's minds are open to change. The problem is the resistance, right? Because the resistance may be a more powerful force than just an open mind. And I mean, look at the leadership we have in this country right now. Look at what this guy is selling to the country.
Yeah.
I'm not so worried about Donald Trump than I am about, you know, the 40% of his core voters that support him. Yeah. Right, that are okay with the words about immigrants. They're okay with the words about blacks. They're okay with the words that he used about the LGBT community. I'm more concerned about that. Those are the guys that we can be hopeful as much as we want to, but you need good policy and legislation because these guys don't want change.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, Kevin.
Okay.
I could talk to you for
yeah,
hours, but thank you for coming in. Kevin Shirt has been my guest. He's a Baltimore writer and youth advocate and a very busy public speaker, the author of three books, Lessons of Redemption, Uprising in the City, and his latest, The Colored Waiting Room, Empowering the Original and the New Civil Rights Movements. Kevin Shirt will be talking about his new book with podcast host Mark Steiner tomorrow evening, starting at 6:30 p.m., at the Enoch Pratt Free Library as part of its Writers Live series, an event co-sponsored by the Ivy Bookshop. We'll have more information about that on our website, wypr.org/midday. Kevin Shirt, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, the managing editor of the African American newspaper, Kamau High, joins me to talk about some of the Afro's top stories this week. But before we go to that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2018, 76 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Two unidentified male homicide victims reported the week before last have now been named by police. They are Tavon Miles, age 20, and Deandra Brown, age 27. In addition, a Baltimore man named Muhammad Amir of undetermined age, who was shot and wounded in January 2015, died on April 5th from pneumonia, and the city's medical examiner has ruled Muhammad Amir's death to be a homicide. And police reported last week that an autopsy conducted on an infant who died last November revealed she was a victim of lidocaine poisoning, and her death has now been ruled a homicide. Indira Anderson was 6 months old. Last week, seven people were the victims of homicide in Baltimore. They include three men and an 18-year-old woman whom police have yet to identify. In addition, these names: Marquise Johnson, age 28. Carlos Chase, age 28. And Dominic Smith, age 27. You're listening to Midday. I'm Rob Sivek. Stay with us.